Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the latest research being done to help preserve and restore vision. And our guest knows a whole lot about that, Dr. David Gamm. He directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at University of Wisconsin. Also, a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Science. And his clinical practice is in pediatric ophthalmology. And his research interest focuses on stem cells and their applications to the study and treatment of human retinal diseases. So we'll talk about new research about glaucoma, optic nerve damage, and a whole lot more. And I hope you'll join in with your questions about eyesight and eye health. Love to hear from you. You can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. David Gamm, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Well, maybe to start, tell us more about the McPherson Eye Research Institute. How does your research there help people and not just people who live in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, so like many universities, we have a wonderful Department of Ophthalmology, and the mission for that department is to treat patients, educate the next generation of ophthalmologists, and also do research. But a huge university like the University of Wisconsin has people doing vision-related research in almost every department across the entire university. And bringing that all together, it can be a very difficult thing to do. So what we have that's unique at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is the McPherson Eye Research Institute, which is a research-devoted entity that doesn't look at boundaries and individual departments or schools and says, okay, what are you doing? Are you working to try to help folks who are facing blinding disorders? Are you doing that in the School of Engineering? Are you doing that in psychology to understand how we see and cognitive issues with regard to our vision? Are you doing that in ophthalmology, wherever it is? And then we bring them all together, and then we get them to work together, collaborate, use their individual expertise and resources, and focus that on helping the people with vision disorders here in Wisconsin and around the world.
Yeah, it's a great idea and a great institute. As we think about the causes of blindness or vision impairment, what are the most common causes?
Well, in terms of, there's treatable versus untreatable. Obviously, cataracts are extremely common. We all kind of face that as we get older, but imminently treatable. For the things that still plague us after, all these years of science, it's still, it's macular degenerative. It's degenerative diseases of the eye. And the eye is, at least the retina, is part of the brain, actually. So, if you go through a who's who of things we don't want to have because there aren't good treatments, there, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, degenerative diseases of the joints, of all of our different organs. So the eye undergoes degenerative diseases, too. And so it's when those building blocks of our tissues or organs deteriorate, we really have a difficult time putting them back together. And slowing that process down or reversing it once it happens remains kind of the brave new world of therapeutics that we're working on.
So is it age that causes most often vision loss?
Age certainly is a risk factor. The alternative isn't great either if you don't age. But it's not just that. There are genetic disorders. So there are a lot of things that we're born with that could either be injuries that we suffered as children or young adults, or just our genetic makeup that predisposes us to losing vision or having parts of our eye degenerate. So it's a combination of congenital or genetic disorders and acquired disorders, which tend to accumulate with age.
Yeah. Well, let's think about macular degeneration to begin. I know there's dry and there's wet.
So, everyone talks about that. So it's interesting because they think of it as two separate entities. So everyone who has macular degeneration basically has the dry form to start with. And you can think of that as kind of a slow smoldering degeneration of a particular layer within the back of the eye called the retinal pigment epithelium. And that retinal pigment epithelium separates the photoreceptors that detect light in the retina from the blood supply, the outer blood supply of the retina. And so as that degenerates, you have two things that happen. One is the overlying photoreceptors that detect light get sicker and sicker too, and that robs you of your central vision. But also that the barrier between the retina and those blood vessels also breaks down. So you can get abnormal blood vessels that grow into the retina, and then they leak or bleed. If that happens, then it's the wet form. Think of it like there's wetness there or swelling.
So can it happen to young people?
Not age-related macular degeneration. So age-related macular degeneration is an acquired disorder that has genetic components to it, but generally occurs in your 50s or older, and the prevalence of it goes up every decade thereafter. Mm-hmm. So if you make it to your 90s, congratulations, but also you've got a good percentage chance in the 20s, 30s, even 40% chances of having at least early stages of macular degeneration. Think of it like your parts wear out. If you live long enough, you know, our parts wear out. Younger people get other forms of macular degeneration, which are not the typical age-related form.
So I understand there are some new treatments for the age-related macular degeneration.
Yeah, they just, in 2023, I think a lot of us were inundated by the TV ads, too. I think Arthur Fonzarelli, for the folks that remember Happy Days, is one of the spokespeople for one of them. And it's promising, but also you got to take it with a grain of salt. So what a couple of different companies found was by modulating some proteins that are involved in the immune response in the back of the eye. And so that's kind of goes back to all the work that was done at, you know, what actually causes age-related macular degeneration. So a lot of research over decades kind of pointed towards the immune system having a potential role in that. And so folks started developing drugs that could target some of these pathways and hopefully slow it down. And a couple of them that focus on proteins called complement factors were shown to, if you follow the amount of degeneration over time, folks that got these injections, and they are injections that go directly into the eye every month or every 2 months, so they're not trivial in terms of going through the treatment. But they showed that it slowed that process down. So it doesn't reverse it. So it can't give you back anything that you've already lost. But if you look at folks that had it versus those that didn't, there was about a 20% or so decrease in the rate of the growth of that area of degeneration. Nobody got improved vision, however. So that's the thing to kind of...
But it didn't get worse.
Didn't get worse. Vision didn't get worse. For most patients, there are potential side effects. It was shown in some of the clinical trials that there's a chance to have some inflammation in the eye, which can be severe. So like any other experimental therapy, you kind of have to weigh, you know, what is it that I expect to get from this treatment? What's the cost? And what are the potential side effects? So it's promising, and I think it's an area that we'll see continue to grow and get better. But right now, it really requires a conversation between you and your retina specialist to determine whether it's right for you.
Is there much that you can do to prevent macular degeneration?
So the answer, I mean, back in the day, people would, we've known for a long time that lifestyle does have a role. And the thing that is probably the biggest risk factor is smoking.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, you know, now that we know that there's an immune component to the disease, it kind of smoking revs that up a little bit. So certainly stopping smoking is important. A healthy lifestyle, if you look at folks who just get, you know, what your grandma told you, regular exercise, eat well, work in antioxidants and a good healthy diet. This goes back to some of the vitamins that are often prescribed for folks or they're told to tell or told to take. Those counteract some of that inflammation as well too. So absolutely. But there is a genetic component too, so that some of us are just more predisposed to having it than others.
Bob in Verona couldn't stay with us, but this is a different issue. But he's starting to have double vision, and he wonders is this a potential sign of multiple sclerosis? And if so, what can be done about it? What treatments are available to restore his vision if you have double vision?
Well, we can spend the rest of the hour on double vision if you want to do that. I do that a lot. So really, it comes down to, like many things, if you say I have a headache, well, there's a thousand different ways, reasons you can have a headache. So double vision is the same way. And so one of the first questions we asked is it binocular or monocular double vision, which means is it true double vision will go away if you cover one eye or the other. So that means that your eyes are not aligned properly. And so if you're that category, there's a whole host of things that can cause that, and they do need to be worked up. On the other hand, if you say, well, it's in my right eye, and if I cover my left eye, I still see kind of two of things or even three of things, which is more kind of what we call ghosting as opposed to true double, then that suggests it's more of a refractive error, which or maybe a need to change your prescription in your glasses. So that's a much less serious thing, although it's still very annoying and needs to be addressed with. But true binocular double vision, where if you've never had it before and now you say, yes, I see two of things, and maybe they're side by side or they're up and down or they're diagonal or twisted, and I never had that before, and now when I cover one eye, it goes away, that's something that we want to work up, because that could be any number of things. It could be cranial nerve palsies. It could, you know, if you've had a recent injury, if you're being treated, it could be medications, all sorts of things.
So Bob and Verona probably ought to go in for a check.
You know, I hate to say it because that's what everybody says, right? But yeah, if it's new onset double vision, then getting it checked is important. Yeah.
Glaucoma, it's another leading cause of blindness, a condition that the Institute is researching, if I'm not mistaken. Symptoms of that?
So the thing about glaucoma is, and there are different types of glaucoma, but the typical one is called primary open-angle glaucoma, and it's a disease of aging again. And the problem with that is it's insidious, so you really don't know. Think of it like, you know, high blood pressure or high cholesterol. You know, it's one of those silent things where it can progress quite a ways without you having any knowledge of it. In its later forms, you lose peripheral vision and then ultimately central vision. And it's one of these degenerative diseases of the optic nerve that can't be reversed right now once it starts. So if you have high risk factors, if you have family history, or even as you get older, getting regular checkups is very important, because we can tell, just again, like checking your blood pressure, right?
Yeah.
When it's too late, it's too late. So getting on top of it earlier allows glaucoma specialists and your eye care professionals to institute relatively easy, you know, drops or changes in your medication to hopefully give you a lifetime of good vision.
Jan in Madison has a question that actually relates to glaucoma. So let's go there. Jan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having this program, Larry. I'm really interested because I have severe glaucoma and have been under the supervision of an ophthalmologist for a long time. About 20 years ago, I had surgery to reduce the pressure that was uncontrolled by drops. And now, over a number of years, I've had very low blood pressure. Pressure of 3 or 4. And the ophthalmologist has made the suggestion of having a revision of that surgery. But I wondered, what is the percentage of success if you have reconstruction of the bleb?
So, okay. So you mentioned a lot of words there. So, and I can tell you're a frequent flyer on the glaucoma end of things because you said the word bleb. So just to give a little bit of background for the listeners. So right now for glaucoma, one of the primary factors is high pressures in the eye, but it's not the only thing, but it happens to be the only thing that we can currently treat. So we try to keep the pressures as low as we can, but it's important for your eye to have pressure, just like a tire, right? If it's blown up too much, that's not good. But if it's flat, it's not good either. So you do have this kind of range that your doctor tries to find that's right for you. And so some folks you can tolerate higher, sometimes it's lower, but 4 is pretty low. And so what we do is we use drops that can act on the normal biological mechanisms in your eye that produce or drain fluid. And that's always the first step because it's the easiest thing to do. If those stop working, then there are surgeries that can help drain the fluid. And those do that in a controlled manner, but sometimes they overdrain or they stop working. And just like everything else, you know, if you have a replacement for your hip, you know, they tell you it's good for 20 years. And they follow you closely. And so in this particular case, that is a low pressure, and for long term with low pressures can have complications. So I do think, you know, your doctor is right to start talking about trying to do a revision. And they're quite successful. Not everything's 100% for sure, but this is not an uncommon situation that you're dealing with. And so there are very straightforward ways to deal with that. And so I would feel confident that your ophthalmologist will be able to handle that. Is it a glaucoma specialist or a general ophthalmologist?
Specialist.
Okay, gotcha. Because these more complicated situations generally go to the specialists. They're more suited to deal with them.
Jan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We're taking a look at eye health today, the health of your eyes, with our guest, Dr. David Gamm. He directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're looking at the latest in eye health with our guest today, Dr. David Gamm, who is director of the McPherson Eye Research Institute at UW-Madison. Questions for Dr. Gamm, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Amy in Edgerton will give you a chance. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
What can we do
for
you?
Show. I'm a former high myope who had cataract surgery about 2 years ago. Since then, I am now seeing zigzag vision for straight lines and straight edges. It's a very odd phenomenon. I haven't gotten an explanation or a solution. Do you have any ideas?
Sure. So first of all, again, we have an educated audience here. So high myope, that means that's short for myopia, and that means nearsightedness. So folks who have a hard time seeing the distance, they're blurring the distance, but if they bring things close enough to their eye, they can see it just fine. The reason you have that is that you have a long eye. So farsighted patients have short eyes, nearsighted patients have long eyes. And because that eye is long, it stretches the retina and makes it thinner and predisposes folks to other problems. And usually high myopia is 6 diopters or more of a prescription. And it's a risk factor for retinal problems. Now, having cataract surgery, any type of surgery inside the eye, is an additional risk factor for retinal problems afterwards. I mean, you have to have it done if you can't see, and people are very careful and the procedures are much more safe, but it does increase that risk a tick. Some of the things that can happen with high myopia, with or without surgery having been performed, is something called metamorphopsia, and that's a fancy word for the zigzaggy lines or the kind of the slight distortion that you can see in the center portion of your vision. Usually it's one eye. It can be both eyes if you have a problem in both of the eyes. But what it does is it slightly, you know, pulls the retina, which is like the film in the camera, out of register with the other eye, and it kind of wrinkles it sometimes too. And if you think about it, it needs to be flat and smooth because the image that you're seeing is being projected onto this film. And if the film is a little wrinkly or a little distorted, then it's going to send a slightly wrinkled or distorted image back to your brain, which does all the visual processing. And that's not going to look the same as in the other eye. And so then your brain has a hard time kind of overlapping that. Now, sometimes that can be caused by something called an epiretinal membrane, and then that can be peeled off. So there are situations where you can do that. It can also come from fluid under the retina. So there are very straightforward diagnostic tests that can be done to determine whether that is. So like a lot of things, you want to, you know, you're very good at describing your symptoms, and an eye care professional should be able to go through kind of a list of what that could be, do the appropriate tests, and then determine what the etiology or cause is. And then the next step is, can we do anything about it? And sometimes there, yeah. You know, there isn't. Sometimes the treatment's worse than the cure, but more and more there are things that we can do. In the rare cases where it just, you know, there's enough going on there that we really can't fix, then we start talking about, if it's one eye, do we want to blur the vision in that eye so it's not doing double damage, wherein not only are you getting that distortion, but it's also affecting the vision in the good eye by overlaying that distortion on top of that in the visual field. So in those cases, we can say, well, you know what, let's just leave that as a backup eye and try to reduce its dominance in your field of view. So there's always something that we can do. It might not always be a great solution, but usually we can come up with something to make your life a little better.
Amy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Terry emailed. Terry's diagnosed with macular pucker. Mm. What can you tell Terry about progression and treatment for this?
All right. Well, that's actually one of the words for what I just described.
Yeah.
That the last caller may actually be experiencing is a pucker, that kind of wrinkling. So, you know, so And oftentimes that is after the vitreous or the gel in the eye pulls forward, or after surgery. High myopes, like I said before, get that as well too. They can progress if so. Oftentimes with macular pucker, that you have this jelly in your eye, and think of it like a pudding, and there's a pudding skin, and that pudding skin is attached to the retina. And so if that jelly detaches and leaves the pudding skin behind on the surface of the retina, it can start to wrinkle. And if it wrinkles and stretches, it can cause that distortion. And that can sometimes be peeled off, as I mentioned, and that can restore some vision, oftentimes not exactly to where you were beforehand. And there is some risk always in doing any type of a procedure or surgery. A retina specialist, if it's something that's been really something that you've been struggling with, the next step would go to be to see a retina specialist and to see what your options are.
You've been researching retinitis pigmentosa, if I'm not mistaken. What are the earliest symptoms of retinitis pigmentosa?
Yeah, so retinitis pigmentosa is a childhood onset or adolescent onset a host of genetic disorders. You know, over 200 different genes can cause it. And it's really one of the prime focuses of my research. It can affect newborns all the way up to teenagers. And one of the earliest signs is what's called nyctalopia, or difficulty seeing in dim lights, dim light situations. So it's the classic situation where you're walking into a dimly lit movie theater and everybody else, you know, can find their seat, but you're completely blind. You can't see anything. And so you're grabbing folks. And it's one of the signs that we tell parents and educators to be aware of, you know. So the child who, when they turn down the lights for the movie in the class, and they get really scared because they don't move their, get out of their seats because they don't know where they're going, they bump into things. That's a red flag. These are rare situations. About 1 in 4,000 folks have some form of retinitis pigmentosa. So most folks that have trouble seeing in the dark, you know, it's either age-related or something like that. But in rare occasions, it can be one of these genetic disorders.
And I would think that would be why regular eye exams are important for people with this.
Yes, yes. So, you know, if you have a diagnosed condition, you know, we have a regular schedule that we're seeing folks depending upon how quickly it progresses, what the treatment is. But even for folks that don't, like I mentioned, we mentioned glaucoma.
Yeah.
There are regular, you know, there are schedules that are recommended by, you know, the American Academy of Ophthalmology and the optometric associations, so that we stay on top of things and don't get surprised when the train's gotten too far down the tracks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned this is a research area of interest for you. Could you talk a bit about the research going on?
So retinitis pigmentosa is one of these groups of degenerative diseases. So these are important genes that are expressed in the cells of the retina, usually the photoreceptors. And because these genes are not made correctly, they cause the photoreceptors to become dysfunctional and ultimately die. So they degenerate. And when that happens, you have this slow, inexorable loss of vision, first in the periphery, so the peripheral vision goes away, and then in the center. Sometimes it can be reversed depending upon the gene that's affected. But for eternity, there hasn't been anything that you can really do for that, because that progression of cell death, there is no way to stop it. There's no way to fix the genetic disorder that's underlying it. So you basically just try to maximize people's vision as they lose it. And that's changed. That's changed over the last 20 to 30 years, where we're now doing genetic medicine and we're doing stem cell-related medicine. I mean, it's still not as far as people would love it to be. And
sure,
there's as much snake oil out there, or more snake oil out there as there is legitimate research. But it's an entire field of medicine that wasn't present when I started 20-some-odd years ago. It was just fledgling. And now it shows real promise for folks to either slow down, or stop, or perhaps even restore some vision.
Jason in La Crosse has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Yeah, when I was very young, I was diagnosed with strabismus. So around 2 or 3, I had a surgery for it. They didn't think that I'd need a second one, but so I didn't, or my parents didn't. And growing up, I kind of noticed something wrong with my vision, ended up being double vision. So I dealt with that until about my 20s, and I had a second surgery. That was supposed to be a quick, simple surgery on the muscles of the eye to bring my eye backwards or back inwards. and that I guess there was a lot of scar tissue and they weren't able to do as much as they'd like. And now I'm going to be 40 this year and I still have double vision and my eye is noticeably, you know, out more than the other one. And I was just wondering if there's anything else that could be done. I tried prism glasses, stuff like that, and nothing has helped.
Okay. So the answer is yes. There's, you know, not knowing your particular case and situation, it's there's always could be extenuating circumstances that would come into play. But what you're describing, and you, as you did it, you did a great job as a historian, is that you had an early onset, what we call intermittent exotropia. So where the eye tends to wander out, and if you're really attentive to something or if something's really grabbing your attention, your eyes will be straight, and then at least when you're younger. But then when you're kind of daydreaming or looking off in the distance, the eye will wander out. It's very common, and it's one of the more common things that we see in pediatric ophthalmology clinics. And it's variable. So the eye will drift out and then be straight at times too. And what I tell folks is that there's no cure for that. You know, if you have an appendicitis and we take your appendix out, you're never getting appendicitis again.
Yeah.
But what we do is we try to reset the eye position such that it won't drift as much or it'll be easier to control. So one of the analogies I use is, and this is not, you know, actually physiologically correct, but, you know, if your eye wants to be, you know, separated from it, one eye wants to be out, you have to work to keep it straight. Let's say you're putting 10 pounds of effort to keep it straight. Well, you get tired. You get tired by the end of the day and that 10 pounds becomes too much and then you'll let your eye go. What the surgery does is makes that a 1 pound weight or takes some of that effort off of your eye and your brain. But still, you know, when you get really tired or that sort of, it might drift. You know, I never tell folks they'll never need a second surgery because at the age of 2 or 3, who knows? I mean, you got 90 years ahead of you. I mean, so how do we know if it's going to last forever? But oftentimes one surgery is all that is needed. But when it happens really early, so you said 2 to 3 years old, so that's a pretty early onset. They tend to be a little harder and they do require more than one surgery. So if I'm operating on someone at that early of an age for an intermittent exotropia, I'm saying, you know, there's a good chance that you might need another one down the line, but that's okay. If we can control you for 10, 20 years and then do then tweak it later, then we're doing you a good service. And then you had a reoperation later on. And honestly, I hope you didn't have to struggle too much with that double vision and the eye alignment not being ideal. Oftentimes people will be told that nothing can be done or you're too old now to have it. And it's really sad because folks will deal with that for decades or their entire life, not knowing that insurance is covered and you could have something done for it. I have no idea exactly what they found. Scar tissue gets a bad rap, but you know, you don't heal without scarring. So there's always, if you go back on any surgery, there should be some scar tissue or some adhesions that you clean that up. You move the muscles as you need to. But muscles can be operated on multiple times. And so if the person who did the reoperation said, really, there's nothing else to do, I'd get a second opinion. I can count on one hand the number of times where I've said, well, there's really nothing we can do.
Jason, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rod emailed us. For years, he's heard about and read about cases where the patient had a serious eye condition, sometimes leading to blindness, and the common complaint is that the eye professional didn't offer him any suggestion for resources to assist them going forward. And Rod wanted to mention the state of Wisconsin offers free services to help people cope with vision loss through the Office for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And wonders why some eye professionals don't offer possible resources. What can we done to educate eye professionals about the services?
I'm really glad he brought that up. We are very blessed here in the state of Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired, Combat Blindness. We have wonderful low vision clinics that do amazing things for folks. And so we all want the new gee whiz therapy coming down the pike, but in the meantime, we want to optimize people's activities of daily living and make sure that they're making the best use of the vision that they have. And the technology that's being developed, within the Eye Institute. So a lot of what we do is not developing drugs, but developing new AIs or computer vision or, you know, things like that that can help folks live more independently with vision loss right now and not have to wait for some fancy surgery that also has risks to it. So I know at the University of Wisconsin in our Department of Ophthalmology, we've got a lot of resources. Sunbrita Mundal is one of our optometrists who does low vision. She's fantastic and really sits down with patients, talks about what technology is available for them in the context of what they do. So it's different. Yeah. It's different from a farmer in a rural area of Wisconsin sure. than it is an accountant that lives downtown. So you really have to sit down, spend the time with folks, allow them to use the different technologies, choose what might be best for them, try it out. If it doesn't work, don't sink $20,000 into something if you're not going to use it.
Yeah.
And the services are available here. And he's right that a lot of folks and a lot of eye care professionals, you know, if there's not something I can offer you, then, you know, see you later. And they don't they don't do the next step, which is, but there is something out there for you. And they're wonderful people and they care about you and they have great technology.
Yeah, I've had folks on from the Office for the Blind and Visually Impaired on the show.
Oh,
great work.
Some of the best people I know.
Yeah, absolutely. Rod, thank you very much for that comment. Dot in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Dot.
Hi. I had cataract operation about a year and a half ago on both of my eyes, and I'm sorry to say, but it didn't do me much justice. And I'm wondering how it can be corrected. Should I still be taking Tiantrin or anything like that?
Yeah. So, again, that always goes back to why it didn't work. So cataract surgery is the most common surgery done in the United States. And so, but it's still surgery. And so even if you're 99% successful, that means there's 1% of folks that undergo it that are going to have an untoward effect. And as often as this surgery is performed, that's still a sizable number of people. A cataract surgery having not the outcome that you were hoping for can be for a number of different reasons, though. One could be that the surgery itself was complicated, which leading to other issues. Or it could be that you have more than one issue going on, so that you you had cataracts, and you did, but maybe you also had a macular pucker underneath that, or you had macular degeneration or glaucoma. And so, you know, you clear the window, the cataract is removed, which is, you know, supposed to be a clear tissue in the center of your eye that helps focus things. So that works, but now you're left with the film in the camera still having a problem, or the optic nerve having a problem. And our expectation is that we'll just get that cataract surgery is going to be what's going to cure everything. But if you have more than one thing going on, it may only incrementally help you, or maybe not even help you at all. We're pretty good at being able to assess folks and prepare them if we don't think they're going to have a great effect, or just say, hey, you know, let's just give it a try. So again, it depends a little bit on what happened with the surgery. If it was an uncomplicated surgery, but you're just not seeing as well as you'd like, then it might require you know just digging into that a little more deeper, being referred to a retina specialist or.
Yeah, I had my own issues with cataract surgery, and I wound up having a cornea transplant.
Yeah. And so that would be a complication of the surgery. And complications, again, happen. The absolute best surgeons in the world, in anything, will have complications. It just happens. It's all a matter of statistics. So what matters is that you get a good, caring practitioner. In an environment where they know how to handle those things when they occur, and they treat you with respect and listen to you along the way.
And I had that surgery many years back now, and I've had no problems since then.
Yeah.
That may be something for Dot, but maybe not. Maybe it's some, as you say, could be something totally different.
Yeah, but in your case, you had the complication and you had to have another surgery, but that one worked well. So again,
yeah.
So hopefully there's something like that for this caller too.
Thank you, Dot. Good luck. Appreciate the call. John in Park Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. A great show. Here's my question. I have wet in one eye, and I'm currently taking injections. I have dry in the other eye. But what I've noticed recently, in the bright sunlight, it seems like, especially after being out a while and walking into the building, I seem to, like, go blind. I just can't adjust. Is that something to do with the macular degeneration?
Most likely, yes, and it's kind of a fascinating thing. You know, we have two types of photoreceptors in our eyes. We have cones and we have rods. And cones are what we use to see color and fine acuity, like when we read things. And it's also what we use almost exclusively in normal lighting or bright light situations. As the light gets dimmer and dimmer and dimmer, we use more of our rods. And our rods can't read a newspaper, but they're good for maneuvering in the dark and in low light situations. And so the macula is populated with cones for the most part. It has rods as well, too, but it has cones. So as those are lost, which is what happens in macular degeneration, you become more reliant on, from a ratio standpoint, on rods versus cones. So that when you're out in bright light, those rods, which saturate and aren't good in bright light, they just kind of cower and wait for the sun to go down. You're relying more on those. And so in those bright light situations, you a lot of folks will have the types of things that you're commenting on there too. And, you know, what do you do about it? Find a pair of sunglasses that helps you. Be careful when you go in from a bright to a dark situation so you don't bump into anything, fall down the stairs. Just exercise caution.
I was, John, I can relate a little bit to you because I've had that situation and coming into a building and then there's somebody there that says, oh, hi, Larry. And and they're a distance away. And for a few seconds, it takes a little time for the eyes to adjust.
Yeah. It does happen to all of us. I mean, that is a phenomenon we all know. Yeah. Like in a bright, sunny day, when you walk into a dark place, it takes you a while to adjust. It just more so when you start having macular problems.
John, thank you again for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. David Gamm, our guest today, directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the UW-Madison. Questions for him? Give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at your eye health today with our guest, Dr. David Gamm, directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Science. So it's great to have him with us. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And we've had some emails here. We should get to those. Mary and Rhinelander emailed us, 68 years old. The last few months, she's had floaters in her right eye, which has turned into what she would describe as if she's looking through a foggy line in part of the eye. She's now noticing floaters in her left eye as well. Anything that can be done for this, or is this just a part of aging?
Well, first of all, you do want to get that checked out. So, you know, the classic signs of retinal tears or detachments are what we call flashes and floaters. And the reason for that is that that jelly that's inside of the eye, if it pulls forward and it's attached to the retina as well. And it can pop a hole in the retina or create a bit of a tear. And when that happens, it releases proteins or even blood if you're breaking a bridging vessel. And the tugging portion of it causes the flashes of lights. It's a mechanical way of stimulating the photoreceptors. Now, most of the time, that's not a retinal tear or detachment. It's just the tugging and the vitreous pulling forward. But you don't know, and it's one of those things. It doesn't hurt. There's no pain involved. And so if you have new-onset floaters, especially if you have a lot of new ones, being associated with those flashes of light, which are like fireworks, you should get that checked out just to make sure that you're not dealing with anything that's a little more serious. Now, what to do about the floaters? Really nothing. You know, there are procedures that can be done. If you've got a really giant one that's right in the center, those carry risks to them. They're not always recommended. And so sometimes it's an annoyance. Most folks don't notice them unless they're looking at a pastel colored wall or a blue sky. So once again, getting it checked out, and then once you're there and having your retina looked at to make sure that nothing more serious is happening, you can ask them what's available and what the risk-benefit ratio is of any possible intervention.
Josh emailed. He was diagnosed with iritis in his right eye in his late 20s. A few years ago, he had cataract surgery in that same eye. Since then, Josh says he's noticed that he's got a floater and his vision is a little foggy.
Okay. Probably, a couple of different possibly different things, kind of apples and oranges. So the iritis is itis is inflammation. So it's kind of a generic term for inflammation in the front part of the eye. The ira comes from iris, but it's not necessarily the iris that's inflamed. It could be anything. But commonly we'll call that iritis. Most of the time, especially if it's just in one eye, it's what we call idiopathic, which means we're idiots. We don't know what causes it. We treat the symptoms. It goes away. It can be the a harbinger of an underlying systemic disease or autoimmune disorder sometimes, but in the vast majority of the case, it's not. And it sounds like it didn't rear its ugly head again, and then you had this cataract surgery. And then after that, I mean, sometimes surgery on the eye can kick up inflammation, and that can cause foggy vision and things like you're describing. So it is possible that that's the case. My guess would be that the cataract surgeon would be able to take a look. It's one of these things that's really easy to diagnose. We just have to look at your eye. We put you in that slit lamp, that microscope that we use, and we just look. And do we see floating around in the front part of the eye inflammatory cells, or do we see things that look foggy? And that's, those are indicative of inflammation. But it may not be inflammation at all. It could be something else that could be causing foggy vision. So, you know, a full ophthalmologic examination just to make sure we know what's going on is important.
Dave in Chippewa Falls, actually, he called but couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if there are any new studies in ischemic optic neuropathy. Do we know what causes it? Are there any new treatments or cures available?
Yeah, so ischemic optic neuropathy is basically a disruption of the blood flow. So the eye needs blood like every other part of our body, and the optic nerve, which is the cable that connects the retina to the brain, also needs a blood supply. And so if the blood vessels get clogged for any reason, you essentially get what's called a stroke. You know, a stroke in the eye is like a stroke in the brain, but it affects your vision and not other parts of your mentation. So right now, you know, if you catch it super early, and that's often hard to do, just like a stroke in the brain, sometimes you can reverse it or it will go away on its own. It'll, you know, whatever the clog is will dissipate and your blood flow will be restored. But if that doesn't happen, then everything that's downstream of that blood vessel that's fed by that blood will undergo degeneration. And so now we're into the same spot we talked about earlier in the show, where in any sort of degenerative disease, that's the area where we really lack good therapeutics right now. So what's being looked at, in addition to what are, you know, better ways to just treat stroke in general.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what medications get, you know, diagnosing it earlier, getting you in, getting treatment faster so that the degeneration never happens in the first place. But if you can't do that and it does happen, then we're looking at, you know, what are ways that we might be able to optimize the use of your remaining vision. How might we be able to replace the cells that have degenerated? And that's kind of where we get into stem cell therapies. That's not ready for prime time right now. There's a lot of snake oil right now that where people will say, yeah, if you pay us a certain amount of money, we'll do this treatment for you or use hyperbaric oxygen or something like that. And really, they're just you know, taking your money and not offering you any sort of treatment or maybe even putting you in harm's way. But there is a lot of legitimate research in this area. We're currently involved with a large group. It's a nationwide group of different universities from Hopkins to here at UW-Madison and the Eye Institute, Colorado, USC. And it's funded by a federal group called ARPA-H, which is kind of an offshoot of DARPA. And it's designed to really look at some of these devastating optic nerve disorders and can we offer a potential treatment for folks in the future. So a lot of research is going into it, but it's a tough one. You know, there's a spectrum of issues that from easier to harder to try to fix. And this is a tough one. The optic nerve contains 1.2 million tiny little wires that connect your retina to your brain. And, you know, being able to reconnect them or restore them is not a simple task.
Joe from Wausau called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if scar tissue from a detached retina surgery will cause complications in a glaucoma surgery.
It shouldn't, because it's in the different part of the eye. So for a detached retina, that's the back part of the eye. So if you think, you know, if you think of the eyeball as a globe, which it is, a hollow globe, the retina lines the back portion of it. Glaucoma surgery is on the front part of the eye. So while the eye is not a huge organ, To an ophthalmologist, you know, that's East Coast, West Coast. Mm-hmm. So they're separated by a good amount of distance. The scar tissue that you're probably talking about is something we call PVR, or proliferative vitreal retinopathy, which can occur and make reattaching retinas more difficult. But the surgical techniques for that are actually improved as well.
I'm wondering about, I don't think we've talked about healing optic nerve damage. Have we talked?
Well, ischemic optic neuropathy that our previous caller talked about is a type of that. So again, there's many different, you know, we use a generic catch-all term, but then if you, you know, lumpers and splitters, you know, there's actually, you know, dozens if not 100 different types of these things. So optic nerve damage can be from blood flow problems. It can be from glaucoma. It can be from any number of different conditions. But ultimately, they all kind of coalesce to the same endpoint, which is this deterioration or degeneration of the cells that make up that optic nerve. And so while the path might be different for different folks, the destination tends to be pretty close to being the same. And so a lot of the focus in the McPherson Eye Research Institute and around the world is, you know, what can we do for those folks that have kind of all arrived in the same the same location, which isn't actually a place you want to be.
Yeah. Jan was wondering, what are some of the common concerns when it comes to children's vision and eye health?
Oh, great question. Near and dear to my heart as a pediatric ophthalmologist. So, you know, the common things are still what we see the most and can still cause the most long-term issues. So a condition called amblyopia, which is more commonly called lazy eye, although lazy eye is sometimes also, you know, if you have a deviating eye or an eye that wanders, sometimes, you know, people use the lazy eye for that as well. But amblyopia is a condition where, for whatever reason, either because the eye isn't aligned correctly as a child, or the prescription in one eye is much different than the other, or the child was born with some sort of condition that affected the vision of one eye compared to the other. But what it does is it degrades the vision in one eye relative to another one. And we learn to see like we learn to walk and we learn to talk when we're little. So just like folks who are deaf, if they don't get hearing aids early, their speech doesn't develop quite normally. And so even if they get them when they're 7, 8, or 9, the speech isn't always there because you kind of miss that window where your brain is looking around going, okay, here, what am I gonna spend my real estate on? And so if an eye does not see well, then the brain will say, well, you know what? I don't want to spend a big chunk of myself paying attention to this eye that doesn't give me good information. And so it will be commandeered for other things. So there's actually physical changes in the brain that you can see. Now, that can be reversed. So if you identify that one eye is not seeing as well as the other one and fix that with sometimes just a pair of glasses, sometimes patching, sometimes drops, things like that, and then you restore a good visual image from that eye, the brain is plastic enough at an early age to fix that. And then you have a lifetime of good vision in that eye. If you miss that window, then it can't be reversed, or it can't be reversed very, very efficiently. And that could be a permanent situation where you have vision loss your entire life.
Some cool things on your website, by the way, the McPherson Eye Research Institute.
Yeah, no, we've got a it's vision.wisc.edu, so WISC for Wisconsin, vision.wisc.edu, and we do a pretty good job. Dr. Lang is our center administrator, and Gail Sturr and Michael Heim. We've got a wonderful small staff that punches well above our weight, and we maintain a really good website. We try to make it very informative for our members, so there are things on there for our scientists and our researchers, but also a lot of things there for the public to know what we're doing. It's part of what we're trying to do. It's not just doing things in an ivory tower. We want to communicate to the people of Wisconsin what it is we're doing and to help you.
And you're doing a great job of that, David. Dr. David Gamm directs the McPherson Eye Research Institute at the UW-Madison. It's great to have him with us. He's also a professor in the Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences. It's great to have him, and I'm sure he'll come back and be with us again. Thank you so much, Dr. Gamm.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, we're going to take a look at organ donation. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.